5, then 10 times. As a result, I've been able to pay back Green Jade's initial investment. So I now own 50% of a thriving business. My success has rippled out. My father and brothers are enjoying what to them are instant fortunes. I can proudly say I helped make that happen. As for Poor's supposed health benefits, it's hard to know what to make of them. Ama made potions from the mother and sister trees, but maybe the people she gave them to would have healed anyway. Maybe her elixirs gave comfort like the Nima's trance or the Ruma's chanting. We believed we'd get better. No one was overweight in my village, but that's because we were poor and didn't have enough to eat. For me, I'm content to see my tea men sipping their tea appreciatively and quietly. The next Sunday, my only day off, I walked to Martyrs Memorial Gardens to Mrs. Chang's bench. The old woman has gnawed at me non-stop. Meet my son. Just once, we'll have dim sum together. If you don't like him, you and I will still be friends. Until I'm little more than a chewed down corn cob. Now here we are, waiting for her precious gin to arrive. From photographs, I know what to look for. A man of medium height, average build. I wouldn't be able to stand one of those heavy Cantonese businessmen. And a full head of hair. From Mrs. Chang's stories, I know he's 38 and an entrepreneur, like just about everyone else in China these days. He exports America's trash, old cardboard and other types of used paper, to China to be recycled into new boxes to ship consumer goods back to the United States, which seems like a utilitarian, if not terribly interesting, thing to do. As a result, he travels often. Mrs. Chang has promised that she's told him nothing of my adversities. I would never speak of your past, nor would I reveal his, she said. These things are for the two of you to come to yourselves. But why worry about that now? Let's first see if you like each other. So for all I know, he may be just as guarded and mistrustful as I am. Maybe he's coming here with the sole purpose of getting his mother to leave him alone about me. I can practically hear Mrs. Chang. Meet Li Yan. Just once. We'll have dim sum together. If you don't like her, nothing is lost. Jin waves as he comes into view, and I have the benefit of watching him stride purposefully towards us. He wears his clothes comfortably, suede loafers, navy blue slacks, and a polo shirt, the real thing, not a knockoff. A few strands of gray at his temples catch the light. His wide and intelligent eyes prove him to be his mother's son. Beyond that, something deep within them instantly puts me at ease. He's arrived with gifts, which he juggles in his arms so we can shake hands. He's a businessman, but his palms reveal the calluses of hard work. He isn't shy, but he isn't too forward either. He's brought his mother what I've already learned is a traditional Cantonese gift, a tin of imported Danish cookies.
And for you, Lian, some tea. You're a young tea master, my mother tells me, so I hope you'll accept my modest gift.
The label says it's a naturally aged pu'er from Laobanzhang, made from the leaves of a single 400-year-old tree. The tea itself is set in an exquisite red lacquer box, whose price may equal my monthly income, which tells me that either he's trying to show off, or he's honestly interested in me because of his mother. "Shall we try it at lunch?" I ask. Before he can answer, Mrs. Chang says,
"You absolutely should. I've arranged a table for you at the Southern Garden Restaurant. You two, go along now."
Jin and I protest. She was supposed to join us, but she's like a snake that swallowed a mouse. As she sets off towards the subway shop,
he says with humor edging his voice.
Together we've just lost our first battle with my mother.
He owns a car, which might impress some women. Sun and moon, who am I fooling? A Mercedes? I'm very impressed. Mrs. Chang told me her son was doing well with his recycling business, but this is very well. But the last thing I'm interested in is money. I like the way he drives, though. Casual, with his wrist draped over the top of the steering wheel. He doesn't honk like a maniac, or swerve in and out between cars to gain an extra few meters either. The restaurant is large and jam-packed. We're led through the labyrinth of courtyards, banquet halls, waterfall grottos, and gardens. We cross over a zigzag bridge and enter a small room built to resemble an ancient pavilion. We're seated at a table that overlooks a weeping willow whose tendrils drift languidly above the surface of a pond filled with lotus in bloom. The waiter brings hot water for me to brew the tea. When I open the lacquer box, however, I'm assaulted by an odor of dirt and mildew.
What's wrong? Jin asks.
I don't know how to say this.
You won't hurt my feelings, he coaxes.
I'm afraid someone sold you a fake. His expression falls. I wouldn't be surprised if this news ended our lunch before it began, but then he smiles.
Taken again? I thought those days were behind me.
There are a lot of fakes, I console him. Even connoisseurs buy fakes sometimes.
From now on, you will always choose our tea, and I'll take care of other things, like ordering our meals.
I spot a good quality pour on the menu, and he orders an intriguing assortment of dumplings. I expect him to talk only about himself, but he keeps the conversation going by asking me questions. Do I like Guangzhou? Do I know how to drive? Would I like him to teach me how to drive? Have I gone to Hong Kong? I end up enjoying myself much more than I thought I would. After our meal, we meander back through the courtyards, stopping to watch the water tumble over the rocks at the main waterfall. When the valet brings around the car, Jin holds my elbow as he directs me into the front seat.
Would you like to go for a walk? He asks once he's behind the wheel. Maybe visit the orchid garden? Or we could go to Shamian Island, sit outside, and have American coffee. Oh, do you drink coffee?
I like coffee, but maybe another time. He must think I'm trying to get out of prolonging this day or seeing him again, because his expression collapses as quickly as it did when I told him he'd bought fake pour. I mean that, I say. Another time. I'm free every Sunday.
Then next Sunday.
And I'm free every evening, I add, which makes him smile. He offers to drive me home, but I ask to be dropped off at the Martyrs Memorial Gardens. We shake hands. He drives off. Before going to my apartment, I sit on a bench and punch in Cite's cell phone number.
I went on a date, I tell her. My first ever.
She laughs in her distinctive way and asks to hear every detail. Over the next months, Jin and I see each other twice a week after work and every Sunday. I don't go to his apartment, and he doesn't come to mine. He may have an expensive car, but I sense he's modest in his aspirations, for he often wears the same clothes. Clean, but the same nevertheless. That, or he's trying to show me that he doesn't mind that my wardrobe is limited. I teach him to drink tea properly, and he's got a fine palate, easily distinguishing between raw and ripe pours by whether they taste grassy, floral, fruity, and sharp, or dark, of the forest floor, cave-like and smooth. He takes me to restaurants all over the city, where I try clams, sea cucumber, and jellyfish. Every bite is strange,
and a lot of things I don't like. At all.
It's true a crab looks like a spider, he says. If you don't like it, then you never have to eat it again.
On those evenings when we don't meet for dinner, a concert, or a movie, I go to the park and chat with Mrs. Chang. She's a clever matchmaker, because the more I ask about him, the less she says, which means the only way to know more is to spend time with him. Jin and I return again and again to Shamian Island to take in the crumbling beauty of the deserted English colonial mansions, western banks, and consulate buildings. We always stop for tea or coffee at an outdoor cafe open for tourists who also like to visit these modern ruins.
Years ago, only foreigners could live here,
Jin explains one evening. From our table, we can see down the tree-lined cobblestone pathway where a young mother chases after her one child.
Chinese could not step on the island without permission. At night, the iron gates on the bridges were locked and guarded. I wonder what it would take to restore one of these houses and bring back its garden.
The idea sounds wonderful but outlandish, so I just nod agreeably. While Shamian Island is charming and peaceful, my favorite place in Guangzhou, we explore other parts of the city too. We take a boat excursion along the Pearl River to look at the high-rise apartment buildings that sprout from the banks, and he showers me with questions.
Do you like the water? Have you seen the ocean? Can you swim?
When I answer, I don't know, no, and no, he comes back with,
Ah, so many adventures lie ahead of us.
It seems like he's made a decision about me, but so much remains unspoken. On Sundays, he drives me into the countryside. We pass what are called villa parks, where rows of identical houses sit in neat lines. Between those enclaves are rice paddies and other fields, where farmers carry buckets of water hanging heavily from poles strung over their shoulders. We visit White Cloud Mountain. It's more like a hill to me, but the views over the Pearl River Delta are pretty. We go to the Seven Star Crags, which, Jin tells me, are like a miniature version of Guilin, with their mist-shrouded peaks and rivers.
One day, I'll take you to the real Guilin, he says. You'll love it.
Today, in what seems like the worst torpor and stickiness of the summer, we drive to Dinghushan, another popular mountain resort, to see the Tang and Ming Dynasty temples. Although it feels like half of Guangzhou is also here, trying to escape the swelter of the city, we stroll along the trails, and Jin takes several photos of me.
Would you rather live in a villa park surrounded by fields and drive to your shop every day? Or would you prefer to have an apartment in the city and visit nature on weekends? He asks.
As though I would ever get to live in a villa, I manage to get out through my laughter. Or own a car? Or have an entire weekend without work?
But what if you could live in the countryside? Would you want that? A villa park is not far away from the city.
He's so earnest. And this excursion reminds me how much I love the purity of clean air, birdsong, and the calming sounds of bubbling brooks and waterfalls. Driving back to the city, I feel refreshed and ready to start the new week, but I also feel homesick. How can I explain to him that while Dinghushan is lovely, the mountains are not as beautiful or as tall, isolated, or pristine as my childhood home? He reads my mind and remarks,
Maybe one day you'll take me to where you grew up, and I'll get to meet your family.
I don't even know what to say. What if he came to Springwell and experienced what I love? The mossy cushion of the forest floor, leaves fluttering in the breeze, and birds and monkeys chattering in the trees? Or would he see my village and my family as backward and crude? So much of my time with Jin, I realize, is spent with contradictory thoughts like these. His comments and questions make my heart feel both sweet and bitter, and leave me confused, but not so confused that I ever say no to his invitations. I never told him about my marriage to San Pa or our trip across Myanmar and into Thailand, but the following Sunday, when he announces,
"You should have a passport in case you want to travel to another country someday,"
I go along with the idea. Of course, it's not easy to get a passport. He seems to know people who know people, though. He introduces me to one cadre and bureaucrat after another.
"She's a businesswoman," he explains to them, following up with, "Do you like poor? Naturally, the health benefits alone. Please accept her gift," and so on.
Once I get my passport, amazing. He advises me to get a single-visit visa to the United States because
you never know what can happen in this country.
He isn't aware that I have a daughter in America, but I fill out the forms, go to the interview, and quietly begin to save money for a plane ticket. After I get the United States of America visa stamp on my passport, I take it out every night just to stare at it. If I went there, could I find her? Jin remains ignorant of the gift he's given me. Hope. But I'm indebted to him for it, nevertheless. I often remind myself of what Mrs. Chang said. Those who suffer have earned contentment. Maybe I have earned it. Although Jin and I are getting to know each other, as Mrs. Chang asked, I worry what will happen if I share my life story. Maybe a time will come when we'll want to tell each other everything, but maybe not. He seems to feel the same way, because our conversations look inward and forward, but never backward. Every word exchanged reveals something, from the insignificant and even silly to the more profound admissions that get to the core of who we are. Who knows? Maybe we are less interested in infatuation or romantic love than in understanding, compatibility, and companionship unmarred by the past.
"I like yellow," he answers when I ask his favorite color. "I don't have many good memories of being in the countryside as a boy, but I did enjoy the spring when the rapeseed was in bloom."
"I'll always love indigo," I tell him. "One might think I'd be tired of it. I wore that color every day until I went to Kunming, and every person I knew as a girl wore that same color. Instead, it reminds me of tradition and the comforts of home." He asks if I like dogs. "I prefer cats, because they're useful and mind their own business," I explain. "Dogs are only good for omens and sacrificial eating."
"Promise me you won't eat my dog."
"You have a dog? I love dogs." It's not a concession. I'm not changing who I am to please him. I'd walk a dog and clean up its poop, like I see people do here in the city, because I like Jin, and I want to spend time with him. Turns out he was joking. A relief. But every revelation is weighed. Could I bear that? Could I live with it? By fall, my feelings for him have grown and changed. He hasn't tried to kiss me. I understand we're from different cultures and that it's unusual for Han-majority people to kiss or hug in public, or for the most traditional couples even to show physical affection in private. Still, every time he uses the tip of his finger to slide a loose strand of hair behind my ear, or takes my elbow to help me into his car, I feel the warmth that got me into so much trouble with San Pa. But I'm not a young girl anymore. I go to a family planning office for birth control pills. If we ever decide to steal love, I'll be ready. But when? I consider how much time we've spent together, and that's when it hits me. He's holding something back far worse than his family's tribulations in the countryside. Of course. So am I. Many things. Part 4. The Bird That Stands Out. 2007 to 2008. A chicken, a goat, and a coin. To celebrate Western New Year's Eve, Jin takes his mother and me to a restaurant at the top of a fancy hotel, which allows us to see the fireworks, giant blooms of light and stars bursting over the city. He orders champagne, which I've spoken about to my customers, but never tasted. Once it's poured, he toasts us, wishing all prosperity, happiness, and golden health in the new year. My toast is to Mrs. Chang. Thank you for befriending a stranger. May this be the first of many New Year's celebrations, Western or Lunar, we share together, she says when her turn comes. Her words are so bold. She's a wishful mother of an unwed man in his late 30s. But I worry her pushing could drive him away. I try to compose myself, hiding my embarrassment behind a pleasant expression, before glancing in Jin's direction. When I do, he's right there, staring at me with such intensity that I immediately lower my eyes to the salted prawn on my plate. A week later, on the first Sunday of the new year, Jin flies to Los Angeles for a series of meetings. When Mrs. Chang and I visit in the park during the week, we don't discuss the awkward moments after her toast, but my mind is full of unspoken truths. I've fallen in love with Jin, but I'm not sure the feeling is reciprocated. I could try to shield my heart and say I don't want to see him, or her, again. But what would that bring me? Immediate loneliness. I want to prolong this emotion as long as I can, even if it will cause me pain in the future. That's when my ama comes into mind. 2 years ago, and now nearly 10 years after Sanpa's terrible death, ama cautioned me, "You shouldn't be alone." She also said I shouldn't let memories of the past turn me into someone I wouldn't recognize. And I guess this proves I haven't, because I'm as foolish and reckless as ever. But she also said, "The right person will find you and love you." And I have to believe that's happened, because truly, won't Jin have a moment when he realizes what he feels for me? What if he proposes, we go to Springwell Village, Ama and Abba like him, and we're married in a full Aka wedding, the kind I should have had all those years ago? What if, when we come back to Guangzhou, we find an apartment together? He certainly won't have a crossbow. But what other possessions might he bring to our home? How will our lives unfold? What if we have a child? Just the thought of that. See? Foolish and reckless. On Saturday, I work in the tea market, but my mind is elsewhere. Jin returns today, and we're set to meet this evening at our favorite cafe on Shamian Island. My shop is busier than ever. I work, pouring, measuring, and selling tea, listening to the conversation between my three favorite tea men. Mr. Lin brags about how many kilos of a 12-year-old pu'er from Laobanjiang he stored. He points to his laptop screen.
"Come, see how much money I made, overnight!"
Mr. Chow says, "Only on paper." Mr. Kwan jokes,
"Only on screen, you mean?"
Then they shift, as they often do, to the size of their temperature-controlled vaults. It's a normal day, except for the thoughts of Jin that keep me from joining the banter. It's a normal day, that is, until two new customers enter the shop. The sight of the older man jolts me out of my daydreams. Mr. Huang! Next to him, a teenage boy, who has to be his son, Xian Rong. A little more than a decade has passed since I last saw them. I'd recognize Mr. Huang anywhere, but these days, he doesn't look so startlingly different compared to the other men in my shop. He's still well-fed, but here in the city, he wears white pants, a striped shirt, and white patent leather shoes. The boy, thin, gangly, with a mild case of acne spotting his face, slouches, keeping his eyes on the floor. They don't recognize me, of course. But seeing them brings back all the ways I failed as an Aka, as a mother, and as a wife. Selling the leaves from the mother tree, abandoning my daughter, and Sanpa's addiction and death.
I'm looking for something truly unique. The more artisanal and rarer the leaf, the better,
Mr. Huang announces, proving that his desires are the same as ever. My trio of tea men take up the challenge.
I have tea picked from 1,000-year-old trees,
Mr. Lin brags.
Mr. Chao goes a step further.
I have tea picked from a single 1,000-year-old tree.
Mr. Quan can top either of those.
A farmer in Fujian province sold me tea picked by trained monkeys.
A bemused expression spreads across Mr. Huang's face. He raps on my table with his knuckles, commanding attention.
But does anyone here have tea picked by the lips of doctor-certified virgins?
My tea men murmur among themselves. Who hasn't seen articles on the internet about this tea? Not only do they have to be virgins, but they're required to have a C-cup bra size as well. Some reports claim that the girls even sleep with the tea on their breasts to infuse the leaves with vitality and virility.
No one believes those stories, Mr. Lin scoffs. If you do, my friend, then you've been duped. Do not feel bad. Even I have bought a counterfeit on occasion from a dealer who claims the material came from forest tea trees, but was not. Or was naturally fermented, but was sentenced to extreme wet storage, with high heat and high humidity to achieve the proper color but not the depth of taste. We must always remember what Lu Yu, the great tea master, told us 1,300 years ago. The quality and goodness of a tea are for the mouth to decide.
How to authenticate? That's the question, Mr. Chao chimes in. Is the seller telling the truth about the vintage? Is the rice paper wrapping original? But like Mr. Lin says, you must know by taste. Your body will tell you. If it doesn't taste right, it isn't right.
Buyer beware, Mr. Quan concludes.
Hearing Mr. Huang's laughter transports me back many years. The skin on my arms reacts, contracting beyond my control, as though I've stepped on a bamboo pit viper. He is a physical manifestation of all my mistakes, even if he wasn't at fault for everything I associate with him.
I like wise men, Mr. Huang says, and everything you say is true. We're like art collectors, no? We taste every day. We know our own teas. No one believes in tea picked by the lips of virgins, because are there any of those left in China these days?
He tucks his chin as he asks.
But will you doubt me when I tell you I was the first to return to artisanal methods to create pu'er?
Xian Rong rolls his eyes, as though he's heard the story 1,000 times. But Mr. Lin responds with a bland,
How interesting.
Then, because he can't help himself, he adds,
Tell us more.
If you're a true connoisseur, then you've heard of me, Mr. Huang says. I started a new era, to make private label tea again.
Are you Mr. Lu, the creator of truly simple elegant tea?
Mr. Chao asks in unveiled awe. Mr. Huang's crowing goes mute, and his shoulders sag. Then his eyes get the steely look I remember so well.
Mr. Lu and I were in the Tea Mountains around the same time. My leaves also hadn't been picked for 40 years.
Were they picked by virgins or monkeys?
Mr. Lin teases. Mr. Huang visibly bristles. I wish he'd leave my shop so tranquility could be restored.
The tea I created is special, very potent.
Dad,
Xianrong interrupts, speaking perfect English. Then to the others he says, "Please forgive my father."
"We have our stories too,"
Mr. Lin says good-naturedly. He clasps a hand on each of his friend's shoulders.
"Come, let us leave the stranger to conduct business with our maiden."
Despite my begging them to stay, my three tea men pack up their laptops, cell phones, and cups.
"We'll return after lunch,"
Mr. Chow announces. Whether to warn Mr. Huang and his son, or to reassure me, I'm not sure. As soon as they're out the door, Xianrong turns to me.
"I apologize for my father. He's like the fisherman who let a big one slip off his line. For him, it's always the one that got away. Every year since he made his first blends, he's traveled to other mountains, trying to recreate one particular tea, which he made into only two cakes."
"But I've been missing one special ingredient,"
Mr. Huang cuts in.
"The leaves from your grove."
A chill runs down my spine. They knew who I was all along.
"How did you know I was here?" I ask.
Mr. Huang laughs.
"I returned to your village last spring. Didn't your family tell you? And then there's my old friend, Tea Master Sun."
My stomach lurches. He was back in Springwell? And he knows my tea master? I thought Tea Master Sun had only tasted Mr. Huang's tea.
"Don't let my father bother you, Auntie," Xianrong says, again in English, this time using an honorific to address me. "He made the mistake of selling most of the tea cakes made on Nanuo Mountain to a Korean collector. Can you imagine what they're worth now? I'll tell you. 1,300 U.S. per cake."
"Wow!"
"Forget the fisherman," Xianrong goes on. "My father is more like Ahab in search of his whale."
All right, so that stumps me. I want them out of my shop. Sweat dampens my armpits, and I tremble despite my best efforts. It's not a big room, and the three of us are standing together, the man staring at me, the boy embarrassed by his father, and me, feeling reduced to an inconsequential, uneducated, two-hill tribe girl. But rather than push them out, I elect to appear friendly and helpful. "Please sit down, and we'll have some tea," I say, keeping my voice steady as I motion to the stools in front of my tea table. We spend the next 2 hours drinking tea and catching up, as Mr. Huang puts it. He still lives in Hong Kong, but he has so many construction projects in Guangzhou that he now maintains an apartment here. He sent his son to Andover, a prep school in America, where he was one of many overseas students.
"But the boy fell in love with a white girl," Mr. Huang complains. "I had to bring him home. Now he's at the American International School in Hong Kong."
Doesn't Mr. Huang realize that his son will have an equal chance of falling in love with a foreigner at the American school?
"He's a senior, 17 years old. We come here on the hydrofoil every Friday afternoon and stay the weekend, so I can teach him the business he'll inherit one day."
The son in question looks about as interested in that prospect as in digging ditches.
"The unridden stallion gets lazy," Xianrong recites in Aka.
His voice still sounds weary, but for the first time since he entered my shop, his eyes have lit up, sparkling with our secret communication.
"A boy who does not have skills will have difficulties. This is true the world over, is it not, Auntie?"
I love hearing the Aka coming from his mouth, and it pleases me that he's retained what he learned as a youngster. In the future, if they visit again, and knowing Mr. Huang's persistent ways, I expect him to come back next Saturday and the one after that, Xianrong and I will have a way to converse without his father understanding. Mr. Huang ignores his son, shifting the conversation to memories of the Tea Mountains and what it was like for them when they first came to Springwell Village.
On the surface, it all sounds polite and harmless. But the whole situation is disconcerting. Mr. Huang pokes at me with our connections.
Why didn't I know he did business with my Abba and brothers last spring? What did I think of Mr. Lu's iconic pour? And why do I suppose Tea Master Sun never told me that the two of them have known each other for years, from time spent in the highest circles of tea connoisseurship?
I opened one of the cakes we made from your special leaves,
he confides, so sure of my interest.
Do you care to hear what I found?
I jut my chin, pretending indifference.
The entire cake was flecked with yellow.
The threads from the mother tree must have spread and grown. But what's even more striking is that this is what Ama told me was in my daughter's tea cake.
The aroma was...
His voice drifts off.
Sublime.
I can't help myself. How did it taste?
He laughs all the way from his belly. I didn't drink it.
This is what Tea Master Sun told me had been rumored during my interview, but I still find it incomprehensible until Mr. Huang continues.
I wrapped it up again. That's what you do with gold, isn't it?
He turns to his son, pinches his cheek affectionately, and then lets his hand come to rest on the boy's shoulder. I remember how Ama always said Mr. Huang loved his boy, and it's still so clear. But Xian Rong is now of the wrong age for such fatherly tenderness. He waits a minute or so before edging away from his Abba's protective touch. In many ways, though, the boy, still unformed and underdeveloped, is more sophisticated than his father when it comes to tea. His ability to taste the brews I pour is unusually refined. At the end of the visit, when his father goes down the hall to the WC and Jian Rong asks if he might return without his father, I listen warily. Once Mr. Huang reappears, strutting down the dim hall, reflexively checking his fly as he stares through the windows of my competitor's shops, Xian Rong's pleas turn desperate.
I beg you, Auntie, please let me visit. We'll speak the language of the mountains and share our friendship through tea.
He seems so lonely and frail that against my better judgment, I agree. The subway is packed, but it feels even more suffocating than usual as I make my way to the shop closest to Shamian Island. Walking alone to the cafe to meet Jin, I struggle to rein in my emotions. Mr. Huang. Why did he have to come to my shop? When the cafe comes into view, and I see Jin sitting at our favorite table under the colored lights with a single cup of tea before him, it's all I can do to keep from running to him for solace. Instead, I take a deep breath to fortify myself, mortar into place another brick to hide my secrets, and settle my face into what I hope is a pleasant expression. When he sees me, he rises, drops a few coins on the table, and leaves the cafe before I reach it.
Lian, he says, his voice serious. Will you come with me?
My mind is in such turmoil that I automatically think he's going to tell me he no longer wants to see me. We walk together side by side. I try to memorize the moment. The height of his shoulder next to mine. The occasional brush of his sweater against my jacket. The sound of our footsteps on the cobblestones. The way the trees rustle above our heads. When he passes through an iron gate and into a courtyard, I have enough sense to call out, "Wait! You can't go in there!" He doesn't respond or even glance back at me. Instead, he strides along the rose-lined pathway and up some steps to the porch of a colonial mansion I've admired, despite its rundown condition. Now, the layers of peeling paint have been stripped away and replaced by a coat of yellow, with the shutters and other woodwork shining glossy white. Jin opens the front door and extends his hand for me to join him. He must know what he's doing, I tell myself, but a part of me is terrified we'll be arrested for trespassing. Once I reach him, he takes my hand, pulls me through a small entry, and brings me into a large room to the right that overlooks the garden and the tree-lined pedestrian walkway. I soak in the details in seconds. Fragrant, freshly cut flowers in crystal vases, hand-woven Chinese silk carpets in intricate designs, antique lamps on the end tables, but recessed lights to create atmosphere. A pair of ancestor scrolls hang on one wall. The opposite wall is dotted with small paintings of life in the city that must have been done when this house was first built. What is this place? My voice shakes. What are we doing here?
For months, we visited spots in the countryside and neighborhoods in the city, he answers. I've shown you villa parks and apartments abutting the river, but always you've seemed happiest on this little island, which is why I bought this house a while ago. I've been restoring it since. I hope we'll be happy here.
I'm too stunned, beyond stunned, really, to speak. My confused silence sends a flicker of doubt across his face. Then he sets his jaw.
I'm asking you to marry me, Lian. He forges ahead. What I mean is, will you marry me?
I answer without hesitation. Yes, I'll go work eat with you. We kiss. I'm dizzy with emotion as the walls I've built to guard my heart crumble. In my chaotic mixture of confusion and joy, I manage to put together a clear thought. I once promised myself I'd never marry unless my mother and father thought it was a good match. I leave out the word again, as in, I would never marry again. Jin can't possibly know that, but a knife of guilt slices into my happiness. Before it can overpower me, Jin delivers into my hands a large and surprisingly heavy package wrapped in homemade indigo fabric.
Open it, he says. Your parents' blessing is inside.
I fold back the layers of fabric to find a new headdress decorated with trinkets I immediately recognize. A silver fish from first sister-in-law, a string of silver balls the size of peas from second sister-in-law, a burst of appliqué butterflies done in third sister-in-law's fine stitches, a coin from Ama, as well as feathers and colorful pom-poms. Beneath that are folded a traditional wedding skirt, tunic, and leggings, plus a belt buckle, earrings, breastplate, and necklaces. All in all, there are perhaps 15 kilos in silver, so much heavier than when I married San Pa, between the headdress and accessories. While I'm trying to take it all in, Jin is still talking.
I've lied to you about some things, he begins. I'm rich, as you can see. I didn't tell you because I wanted you to love me for me and not just for my money. But that's not my only lie. This week, I wasn't in Los Angeles. I was in Spring Well.
My cheeks flush in embarrassment to think of him in my backward village.
It wasn't my first visit, he continues, purposefully ignoring my obvious shame. In the last 6 months, I've traveled 4 times to Spring Well to meet your family and ask permission to marry you.
He pauses to let that sink in. Then,
your father kept telling me to come back another time.
I cover my eyes and shake my head. This is too much.
They wanted me to prove to them you were happy. I brought photographs I'd taken of you. I wouldn't accept no. I even met with your, what is he called? The person who selects propitious dates, like a feng shui diviner?
The Ruma.
He gave me a date.
That Jin's been planning this moment for such a long time?
And that's not all, he goes on. It seems a spirit incantation needed to be held for me. No one told me why, but it included the killing of a chicken and a goat, and the passing from hand to hand of an old coin.
What was that all about?
He inquires genially.
Are they asking us to come home for the wedding?
I manage to choke out, because I'm not about to tell him that a special ceremony must always be performed when a widow remarries, so her new husband won't have his life cut short. The goat is added to protect the new husband of a widow whose first husband died a terrible death.
Your mother had a different idea. It seems she's heard about honeymoons, he says, bemused. She thought you might like a honeymoon in America.
He grins as he confides. She pulled me aside to tell me that the first time I visited. Which means she liked him from the beginning. Which is why I now have a wedding outfit, as well as a passport and visa. But which also means she deliberately wanted to remind me of Yunye.
Even before I met you, he says, my mother made me love you. Then, when I saw you the first time, sitting on the bench with her, you were even more beautiful than she described.
Beautiful? Since we Akka don't use this word to describe people, this is the first time it's been applied to me. Beautiful.
My mother liked you because she saw you as hard-working and honest. Please forgive me for my lies. I promise they won't happen again.
I have to bite my lips to hold back my emotions. He's been keeping secrets, but they've come from a place of goodness and kindness, while mine... How could I have said yes to him when I don't deserve him? I bow my head and let the tears come. He pulls me into his arms, probably believing I am overcome by happiness. I lay my head against the softness of his sweater. I feel the warmth of his body and the beat of his heart. For a few seconds, I allow myself to relish what might have been. Then, I make myself pull away. I cannot go into marriage with lies and secrets as my only dowry. I love you, I say, and I would love to marry you, but you may not want to marry me when you know the truth about me.
Nothing you could say would make me think less of you.
You haven't heard my story yet. We sit on the couch, facing each other. Jin holds my hands, and I hesitantly begin to speak. I start with the easiest and least damning sin I've committed, that I broke a promise to my ama by selling leaves from my grove, which should only be used for medicinal purposes and shouldn't have gone to any man, especially someone like Mr. Huang. Jin easily accepts this, saying,
"You were young and poor. You made a mistake, and it sounds like the mother tree was not permanently damaged."
Next, I tell Jin about being married and widowed. His eyes widen with each new detail. When I get to the end, he takes time to compose his response.
"I've never been married," he says at last. "But would it be fair for me to look into your eyes and deny that I've been with other women before you? If I'd grown up on your mountain, I would have been married too."
"Whatever happens next," I say, "I want you to know that I'll always think of you as an honorable man." He squeezes my hands, giving me strength. "Before San Pa and I were married, I got pregnant. I didn't realize it until after he'd gone to Thailand, so he didn't know. I gave birth in secret and abandoned my daughter. By the time San Pa returned to Nanuo Mountain, she'd been adopted by a family in America." Jin slowly releases my hands, stands, and crosses to the window. He keeps his back to me, as though I no longer exist. I don't blame him.
I sigh and get up to leave.
Wait, he says, swiveling to me.
Twin trails of tears trickle down his cheeks, which he roughly wipes away.
You're very brave, Lian. Far braver than I am. We both have secrets. But you had the courage to be honest with me.
He visibly struggles.
One mistake can change the course of your life. You can never return to your original path or go back to the person you were.
That's how I've always felt. If I hadn't taken a bite of Sanpa's pancake, if I'd only listened to Ama when she said she didn't want me to see him, if I hadn't let false ideas of the future compel me to sell leaves to Mr. Huang.
But nothing you did resulted in death.
He pauses to make sure he has my full attention.
I am responsible for my father's.
How can you say that? I ask, bewildered. Your father died of pneumonia. You were a child when he got sick.
Perhaps you can understand a little of what it was like for my parents. They went from Guangzhou to a village in Anhui province called Moon Pond. Such a pretty name, but it held only darkness. I was born there, and we lived in a one-room shack made from mud bricks. It was more miserable and wretched than anything I've seen in your village.
That stings, especially since he didn't see Spring Well before all the changes. But this is not the time to take offense.
My parents lost their positions, clothing, papers, photographs, friends, everything,
he goes on.
The only tokens from the past they carried with them were 5 of my father's philosophy books, which they kept hidden under the wooden platform that served as our bed. My mother learned how to haul water, wash clothes by hand, and make soles for our shoes from whatever scraps of paper she could find. My father gathered night soil from different families and hoed it into the fields. My parents weakened from the physical demands of working under a merciless sun or being soaked to the bone during the monsoons. My earliest memories are of having dysentery from the bad water and poor sanitation. We were all sick.
He takes a moment to ask,
"What do you remember of the Cultural Revolution?"
"I was born not long after it ended," I answer softly. "Besides, we were peasants already. My family and all our neighbors had always lived that life. But I have a friend, Teacher Zhang. He was sent to Nanuo Mountain. He suffered."
"Suffered," he echoes.
"Suffering takes many forms. Hunger, cold, fear, physical and psychological pain. The villagers were bad enough. They had opportunities each day to torment us. But sometimes a Red Guard unit would visit. Everyone was forced to gather together so that my parents could be publicly punished and humiliated. They endured numerous self-criticism sessions. I don't remember much about my father anymore, except that sometimes, late at night, I'd wake up and see him reading one of his books by the light of our oil lamp. He'd quickly close it, put it back in its hiding place, and say to me, 'You're only dreaming, son. Go back to sleep now. Forget everything.'"
Jin falls into a melancholy silence. I suspect where his story is going, which doesn't make it any easier to hear.
"The Red Guard came again just after my 5th birthday," he resumes at last. "They were so young, you know? They played with me. They gave me a piece of candy, the first I'd ever tasted. I thought they liked me. When they asked me if my mother or father kept anything hidden, I eagerly volunteered what I knew. After that, they dragged my father from our home and made him kneel in broken glass. They tied his arms up and back into the airplane position. Then they beat him with switches. They tore every page out of his books and set them on fire. They made me stand right in front of him, so he would forever know
who betrayed him.
You were only 5, just a boy.
But what son does that? He asks, tortured. I broke his heart and his will to live or fight for us. The rest is what my mother told you. My father got pneumonia and died very quickly.
My heart aches for him. Those were deviled times filled with very bad people, I say, trying to offer comfort. You were a little boy, and you were tricked. Tragedies of this kind happened to people who were far older and with far more knowledge than you had. You can't blame yourself. But of course he can, because I blame myself for so much, too. I take hold of his arms, and our eyes meet. What I'd always seen in them, I now recognize from looking in the mirror at my own reflection. Pain and guilt. You said earlier that one mistake can change the path of your life forever, I say. It sounds like it did for you. I know it did for me. But what if this is an opportunity to do something purposefully right? Won't that put us on an entirely new path? A good path? Maybe even a happy path? Will you still have me? My new life requires adapting to one surprise after another. The next day, Jin and I drive to the airport to pick up Si-tae, who's agreed to leave her husband and daughters for a month, to take care of my shop while I'm on my honeymoon. She's arranged to have the most recent batches of tea my family made, as well as several kilos of pu'er from Lao Banjiang sent directly to Midnight Blossom. My impression? Seeing her for the first time out of Springwell Village? Chubby and too, with her ill-fitting Western-style clothes and numerous overstuffed bags made of red, white, and blue plastic mesh hanging from her arms. Si-tae catches the judgment in my eyes. So the first thing she says to me is, I'm the first person from Nanhua Mountain to fly on an airplane. Ours is a long and complicated friendship, and I'm beaming at the joy of it. Next, we pick up Jin's mother and continue straight on to the marriage bureau. Si-tae and I peel off to the ladies' room so I can change into my Aka wedding clothes, and she can ask what feels like dozens of questions. Has your future husband tested the machete yet? The last time I heard that phrase was when the Ruma asked it of Sampa as part of our wedding ritual. When I tell her no, her eyes go as wide as soup bowls. Don't they have a flower room in Guangzhou? She asks. No, but there are many equivalents where boys and girls, men and women can be alone together for talking and kissing. Bars, nightclubs, a friend's apartment. I apply lipstick so I don't have to answer the question. Then you must have stolen love in the forest by now, she presses, so nosy. Do you see forest around you? I ask, starting to get irritated. Besides, I already told you, he hasn't tested the machete. Undaunted, Si-tae changes the subject.
So, how rich is he?
Rich enough to buy you a plane ticket. I answer.
I didn't need him to fly me here. I could have bought my own ticket, she brags. My family now makes 100 times what we did just 5 years ago, all because of poor.
She laughs, giddy, I suppose, at the craziness of the changes we've seen. But crowing about her own wealth serves to bring her back to her original subject.
Really, how rich is he? A millionaire? A billionaire?
I don't know, and it doesn't matter to me anyway. I've been reciting these phrases to myself the past 24 hours. In truth, I wouldn't mind having the answers, although a part of me is afraid of them.
Would he invest in a business with me?
As I put on my headdress, I meet my friend's eyes in the mirror. Si-tae, you already sell your teas through my shop. Are you hoping to compete with me?
I've kept the question light and teasing.